And tonight, our main speaker is, help me welcome Bill.
Everybody get the breeze, Hi, my name is Bill and I'm an alcoholic. I'm sober tonight through the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of AA since April 8th of 1962. I got sober when I was 10, and for that I'll be forever grateful about being 10. And I want to thank the group for inviting me. It's a privilege to be at this group. I have a lot of respect for this group. It's a wonderful group. And I appreciate the invitation. I also appreciate the fact that your group really focuses on sponsorship, because without sponsorship, I would not be standing here. The man that became my sponsor, when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1962, was a gentleman named Benny. He's a Jewish jeweler from Brooklyn, New York. And there was something about him that was so special. And he was my sponsor for the first 31 years of my sobriety. And then he died of a sudden heart attack. And then I got Jimmy, an Irishman. He was my sponsor for the next 10 years. Great guy. And then he had open heart surgery and he didn't make it. And then I got Leo, and he was my sponsor for the next 8 years of my sobriety. And then Leo passed away from cancer. And now I have Eddie, and he's kind of nervous. But that's the way it goes. I said, nobody is indispensable in this life, you know. And I'm looking forward to joining my sponsors in heaven one of these days in a much distant future. Speaking about heaven, I have found heaven in Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's no doubt about it. I have found what we talk about, a life beyond my wildest dreams. And it has been that, and it continues to. And you know what? The best is yet to come. And when I listen to all you young people standing up with so many days of sobriety, and you have no idea what kind of tremendous life you have ahead for you if you do not pick up a drink and work this program. It's incredible. I mean, and I speak from experience. When people told me that when I first came in, I said, you know what? What, are you kidding me? You know, I had such low expectations, you know. I mean, I had to reach up to touch bottom. That's where I was at the time, you know. But everything they told me not only came true, far better than true. And speaking about heaven, I love that story about these two Irishmen, you know, Pat and Mike. And two terrible drunks, and they finally get sober in AA, and they find AA and heaven in AA. And then it's getting older and getting longer in the tooth. And they wonder if there's going to be AA in heaven. So they make a pact that whoever dies first will come back and tell the other one whether there's AA in heaven or not. So Pat dies first. And one night Mike's in bed, and poof, Pat shows up. And he's Pat. He's, well, I promise I come back and let you know. He says, well, tell me, is there AA in heaven? He says, not only is there AA in heaven, it's fabulous. But I have good news and I have bad news. What do you want to hear first? He said, well, give me the good news first. He said, I said, it's fabulous. They have these huge open meetings like this every night of the week in heaven. And they have fabulous speakers, kings and queens and wealthy and poor and actors and actresses. And it's fantastic. These great open speaker meetings. And so much. Mike says, well, then what's the bad news? He says, you're speaking tomorrow night. As you can tell, I love to laugh. I just love to laugh. When I came here, I hadn't laughed in a long, long time. As a matter of fact, my sponsor said I had my head so far at my rear end, I needed a porthole in my stomach to look out, you know. So and that being a writer, I thought that was kind of visual, and it was absolutely true, you know. I mean, I did everything. It was, oh, so sad, so sad. My life was so sad, you know. Terrible, you know. But I came here, and I heard you guys laughing. And I said, what the hell are they, nuts? What are they laughing about? And then I found out. You found life. You found life. See, God bless you. You hope you're not catching anything. I'll talk this way if you'd prefer, you know. But, anyway, life. I didn't have life when I was. I thought I had life when I was drinking. I come from an alcoholic home, like many of us have. I hated my father. He was a terrible drunk. Hated him. Never going to be anything like him. I became like him. I became worse. I can't tell you why or how or anything like that. All I know is I got the disease. And before you know it, I was in very, very bad shape myself. But I had a great many great opportunities, just like you all have had. The trouble is this disease takes away from us everything that's near and dear to us. And then it either kills us or, worse, allows us to live or exist with this disease. And you and I have both seen what happens when we simply exist with this disease. You wind up on a curb picking lint out of your navel, drinking out of a brown paper bag. And that's the final stages of this. Or you wind up in a wacky ward. Or you wind up in prison. There's no out. There's no way of out of this disease. And so I had it in spades. But I was young. I was. I became a newspaper reporter in this great city of New York. Got a real lucky break. This was then the town of 18 newspapers. Imagine that, 18 newspapers in the city. Heyday of journalism back in the 50s. And today there are only 2.5 papers left. Imagine that, just 2.5. Yeah. Well, there's the News and the Post and that thing called the Journal American. The New York Times, anyway. I'm entitled to my opinion. You get up here and you can spout your opinion, but I'm entitled to my opinion, you know. Anyway, right, Peggy said I'm right, okay. And I did great. I had a fantastic career. I mean, I started as a police reporter, and by the time I was 22, they found I could write. And so they made me a byline feature writer for the largest evening newspaper in the world. I say that because it sounds like bragging, but it happens to be the truth. The truth, and there's nothing wrong with telling the truth. And but then by the time I was 25, I became the obituary editor for the same newspaper. And there's a big difference between those two jobs, by the way. It's a byline writer. I traveled around. I was sent down to Tuscaloosa when George Wallace was barring the doors of the university against blacks. Covered the last execution of Sing Sing Penitentiary. Before Sputnik shot up into space. Boy, am I aging myself here, Peggy. Then I kept getting fired for being drunk and turning in phony stories, cheating my expense account, you know, all the stuff that drunks do, and I did them all. And at the age of 25, I was now sitting in the city room at 3 o'clock in the morning calling up funeral homes to find out what well-known people dropped dead that night. I could hardly handle that, but I got there because my drinking got out of hand. And I was spending most of my time in Moochie's Saloon on South Street. And so I didn't have any time now to call a funeral home, so I would tear the obituaries out of other newspapers. And I'd send them into the Composium. But we began printing obituaries of guys who died a couple of days ago, you know. And I was getting notes in my mailbox in a city room from my city editor saying, we want fresh obits, fresh obits. And I'm saying, what the hell's a fresh obit? The guy's dead, right? So I think this guy died 3 days ago, and I knew I was going to get fired, so I quit. Had a friend of mine who was working for a weekly news magazine. He liked the way I wrote, so he hired me. And I traveled around all over the country again for this weekly news magazine. Lasted there three and a half years, I guess it was. And about to get fired from that, because I wrote a story where I interviewed 5 different politicians in Las Vegas. I never met them. I just made it up. I had press releases, but I just, you know, interpolated the press releases. So I was about to get fired from that, and I quit, and I got a job for WOL Radio here in New York, writing radio shows. Trouble is, you know, radio is tough on deadlines. You know, if the news goes on at 9 o'clock, you've got to have your copy in by at least 8:45, you know, not 9:05. So I was about to get fired from that, and I quit. I got a job with a small PR firm. So that's my career as a media drunk. Great opportunities, wonderful opportunities, and I drank them all away. So if you're in a process of drinking something away, it's better to stay sober and hang on to it and then go far, far, far further ahead. So this disease affected my job life. I married a young girl Actually, I hadn't got engaged to another girl, and she didn't like the way I drank, so she broke off the engagement. And I met this other girl who had studied to be a nun. And believe it or not, I had studied for 4 years to be a priest before I became a reporter. And so now a priest and a nun. Once I got into Bernadette's habit, it was all over, you know. So then we began to have children. And it's very difficult to be an alcoholic, a father, a husband, a worker, neighbor, all that kind of stuff, on the kind of salary I was making. So I began to borrow money from finance companies. I got into deep debt with finance companies. Then I started borrowing from loan sharks. My favorite loan shark was a guy named Richie Baldino. Isn't that a great name for a loan shark? Richie Baldino. Big, heavyset guy. He carried his stick and was always wanting to break my knees. But a little story about Richie Baldino. If anybody is sitting here tonight and has a real serious problem in their life and don't know how it's going to work out or how they're going to get through it or what, I owed Richie $17,000 by the time I got to AA. Never borrowed that much, but the vigorish, you know, the vigorish. And I was sober about a month and a half, and I was worried about Richie Baldino. What am I going to do? And I said to my sponsor, I owe Richie all this money. And then one day I hear that Richie died of a heart attack. And I said to my sponsor, what am I going to do now? I owe him all this money, and now he died of a heart attack. He says, well, then pray for him. So anyway, that's how God works sometimes in our lives. That's well, Richie is now in, you know, he's in now loan shark heaven, I guess, wherever loan sharks go. And I just dragged my wife right down with me to this disease. I drank up two homes, and we wound up living in my wife's mother's basement in Richmond Hill, Queens. And it was an unfinished basement, so the kids slept in cribs around the walls, and my wife and I slept on two cots behind the oil burner. But it was nice and warm, you know. And by this time, I was a very, very sick man. And my wife wanted to leave me. And my mother-in-law, her mother, said, you can't leave him. He's a very sick man, and he needs your help. And then when I got sober, I was sober about 3 months. It takes, generally, for the new people here, it takes about 3 months to get to know everything, see? And so when I got to know everything, my wife couldn't stand me, and she wanted to divorce me. And my mother said, you can't leave him now. Somebody else will get all the good stuff, you know. So she had a wise mother. My mother used to call me Doozy Potts. If you're Italian, that means you're nuts, right? So anyway, but the thing I hated most about living in that basement, to go into the basement, you had to go through the side door and down the stairs, and you had to pass my mother-in-law's dining room to get to the basement. And my mother was always sitting at the dining room table praying. She was a little short, lovely Italian lady, but I hated her guts because I knew she was praying for me. And I thought it was beneath me to have somebody praying for me. Because by this time I had walked away from God. But she kept praying. And sometimes I'd be drunk as a skunk and I'd scream and yell at her and sometimes use profanity. She'd never said a word to me. Here she saw what I was doing to her daughter and her grandchildren, never said a word. Just kept on praying. I think she's prayed me into Alcoholics Anonymous, I really do. It all came to a head in first week of March of 1961, when our youngest daughter, we had four children at the time, got very sick, had a kidney infection, had me taken to the hospital, and my wife tried to reach me, and she finally found me somewhere in New York here, and she begged me to come to the hospital, maybe was sick. So I had a few more drinks. By this time, I was unemployable. I couldn't find a job after that PR firm fired me. And I managed to get to the hospital, and I fell out of the cab when I got to the hospital, and my wife started crying hysterically. And then she begged me not to see our daughter in the hospital. On the way home, we stopped at a Chinese restaurant, and she said I ordered nine drinks. And I don't remember much of this, but she's told me this, and I believe her. And she looked at me, and she had done this a few times, and I hated it. I didn't mind if she screamed and hollered, but she looked at me, and she said, Bill, why? Why are you doing this to yourself? Look at you. And the picture that she was seeing was a young man, 27 years old, who drank every day in the week, everything he got his hands on, who weighed about 330 pounds, fat, bloat, stinky, drunk, And I said, I don't know. I had asked myself that question many times. Why did I do this? Why was I doing this? Haven't we all asked ourselves that question? Why? I've come out of blackouts and sleazy saloons and not knowing how I got there, and the same question, why? And so I begged her. I said, there's something wrong with me, and I think I'm going crazy. And Bernadette is a very active lady, and you don't just mention something like that and just let it. She never lets it pass. So she called up our family doctor, who suggested I see a psychiatrist. And the following Saturday afternoon, I was sitting in front of a psychiatrist. And he asked me why I was there, and I told him I thought I was going crazy. And I began to tell him what the things I was doing, that I was doing them over and over and over again. And then he stopped me, and he looked at me, and he said to me, you drink a lot, don't you? And I didn't know what that had to do with the conversation. I really didn't. I had stopped and had about 7 or 8 double shots before I went to see him, because you got to get ready for, you know, big things like that, right? Seeing a psychiatrist. So he went through, he said, do you drink beer? I said, yeah. Do you drink rye? I said, yeah. Do you drink scotch? I said, yeah. Do you drink gin? I said, yeah. And then he said, do you know what an alcoholic is? And I said, I certainly do. And I described a guy on the Bowery, right, sitting on the curb, picking lint out of his navel and drinking booze out of a paper bag. And he said, that's one in the final stages of a disease. He says, I think you are an alcoholic. And I wanted to punch him right in the mouth. I remember saying to myself, I came to this bum out of the goodness of my heart for help, you know. And here he's insulting me by insinuating I'm an alcoholic. And he said, I can't help you if you are, Bill, because, you know, we psychiatrists, I can help you when you get sober, but I can't get you sober. But I know some people who can. And he gave me the phone number of the Integral Office of AA, and he told me to call him up. And he said, no sense coming back to me. He says, it's $100 a visit, and if you want to keep on drinking, you're going to need the money. He was very straight, you know, very straight guy. So I went over, now how do you go home and tell your wife that the psychiatrist thinks you're an alcoholic? So I paraphrased. And I said, he thinks alcoholics are very, very sensitive, first of all, I'm sure he said, they're very intelligent people. And she nodded, and then I said, he said they're very sensitive people, and when they get upset, they have to reach for a drink. So he told me to tell you to stop yelling at me from now on. And it's all your relatives to lay off me, too. So she said, what else did he say? And so help me, Peggy knows this. She knows Bernard, my wife. And I said, he wants me to go to AA. And she looked at me and she said, how is American Airlines going to help you? Swear to God. You know, I never let her live that down, you know. So anyway, I went over to AA and I went to a few meetings, but they're a bunch of old guys telling war stories. I was the youngest by 30 years in the Woodhaven group in Queens. And I said, maybe I need this someday, but not right now. A year later, first week of April of 1962, I'm sitting on the window ledge of the old Margarita Hotel downtown, ready to jump. My life was over, 28. I now had DAs looking for me on bad check charges. I was deeply in debt. My children were afraid of me. I thought my wife hated me. I mean, I had no reason to go on. 28 years old, my life was over. That's the way I felt. But God had other plans. And for some reason or other, I crawled back into them. And I went home and got in touch with a guy named Joe, who I met a year before. And he said, would you like to give AA another try? And I said, please, Joe, please. And he brought me back to the, not only did he bring me back, the following day was April 8th of 1960. It was a Monday evening. I never will forget. And this big old blue Packard. Most of you young people never heard of it, but it could seat 8 people, a Packard, you know. And my sponsor's driving it, and he's got 6 other guys in it, and they put this 300 load of 300 pound stuff in the back seat, and they took me back to my meeting. And after the meeting, they put me in the kitchen to wash cups and saucers and spoons and forks and knives. And back in those days, we didn't have styrofoam cups. You can't get sober washing a styrofoam cup. Can't. And then he showed me the way. And Benny led me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to understand I had a disease. I didn't buy it at first. I thought you would let me off the hook, but I had a disease. And he changed my life. You changed my life. Every single person that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not just saying that. That's the truth. We change each other's lives because we are willing to do anything, anything at any time, any day for each other. The unconditional love of Alcoholics Anonymous is what got me sober and what keeps me sober. There's nothing like it. I go to church, I'm back in my faith, but I don't even find, you know, I guess it's there, but I find it in enormous tons of Alcoholics Anonymous. As I said, I had very, very low expectations. I thought maybe I'll just find a little job, enough to make a few bucks, get a little apartment, you know, that kind of stuff. And my sponsor said, the heck you will. He said, if you had the talent to do what you did before, you got to do the you got the talent to do 10 times better. And I began to get back to work. We moved to Nashville, Tennessee, because I couldn't get a good job in New York. And then from Nashville, Tennessee, we moved to Cleveland. And then in 1968, there were three guys in Cleveland that put up some financing, and I came back to New York, and I started my own business. And in 1969, I got with three partners into the film business. And since that time on, I've been writing books and movies. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful career. And you know, God gives us talent for us to use for Him. It took me a while to come to understand the real reason why God brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we think in the beginning, at least I did, that He brought me in to become a better man, a better husband, a better father, a better worker, you know, a better neighbor, a better, all that. That's not why He brought me here, and that's not why He brought you here. I found out that's the fringe benefits, all that stuff are the fringe benefits. That God brought me here, He allowed me to go through what I went through, and then brought me here for only one reason. To be a useful tool for Him to help someone else. That's what this thing is all about. When Bill and Bob sat together in Akron, Ohio, 1935, and they reached out their hands, and Dr. Bob said, what can you do to help me? And Bill Wilson said, I didn't come here to help you, man. I came to help me. That's what it's all about. You came here, and we thought, you came here so we could help you. No, you came here so you could help me. Without the new people coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, who else are we going to help? You know, they say the new person is the most important person. I don't know if that's true or not, but boy, they sure close to it. Because Alcoholics Anonymous is what saves lives today. And so I'm really very, very grateful. I have a wonderful family today. I mean, we had four children, and we now have nine. You know, because a lot of things begin to work again when you sober up. And my wife hates when I say that. She doesn't. 24 grandkids, two great grandkids. And imagine having all that at the age of 51. It's incredible. It really is. It's just absolutely. You know, I keep kidding around about ages because age doesn't make a damn but a darn bit of difference. It really doesn't. It's how you feel inside. You know, and inside, I can still shoot the set shot. I really can. I mean, I can score a three-pointer as good as you can. I mean, and I really do believe that the best of my life is yet to come. If I were to tell you what I'm working on now, you wouldn't believe it. It's incredible, and it all comes from God. It all comes from God. It took me a long time to come to really, really, really understand that. I gave it lip service for a long time in this program. Yes, my higher power, yes, yes, yes. And I would get down on my knees and tell my will and open to Him. Oh, yeah. It took me a long time to come to understand. And some serious things, situations, to come to understand that God is real. Not a figment of my imagination. Not a spirit somewhere off in the distance. Not an old man with a long beard with a Bible in his hand sitting on a cloud somewhere. All that, you know, immature nonsense. Did you give me 1 minute yet? I got five? Holy mackerel. Holy mackerel. I feel like I just inherited something. I never, you know, if you had heard me speak 10 years ago, you wouldn't hear me. But God has become so real in my life and so real in my relationship with my family and with my wife. And the other things that I learned is that things don't happen in Bill's time. things happen in God's time. I work on a project, and I say to myself, and I even say to God sometimes, you know, look, this is really, this is important, this is good, I'm putting everything into it, I mean, and I'm living right, I'm doing right, and you know, so I mean, therefore, you've got to make this thing work out. And he'd say, you know, and you know why? Because I've come to believe that he loves me so much, he's not going to give me anything that's not good for me. And what I mean is not just, you know, he's not going to give me too much money because he knows me too well what I'm liable to do with it. I mean, he's not going to give me something that's going to really bloat his big ego that I already have, you know. I mean, he's just going to, you know, wait until I'm ready to handle it. And I've experienced that with a number of things in my life, and I continue to. So when I do something and get involved in something, whatever it is, I know now. If it's going to happen, it'll happen in God's time. But if God wants it to happen, it'll happen. You know, it definitely will happen. And so I live a life beyond, as I said, my wildest dreams. I don't know how else to describe it. To close this, I want to tell you just one more thing about my mother-in-law, who, as I say, I came to hate and then came to love. We were living in Nashville, Tennessee. Now, this is a woman who had seen me in the worst part of my drinking, when I was very close to the bottom, if not at the bottom. See what kind of a reprobate I really was. Now we're in Nashville, and I'm sober about 2.5 years. And we're having Robert, another son. We have 6 boys and 3 girls. And so Bernard was getting tired, so she said, can I ask Mom to come down and spend some time with us? I said, sure. So I flew up to New York from Nashville, Tennessee, and put Mom on a plane, and together we flew down to Nashville. But I never forget, we're out on the runway, and Mom is saying her rosary beads. And I said, Mom, I hope you're saying those for me, because if this plane goes down, you're going to go up, and I'm going to go down with the plane. And you know, she looked at me, she says, no, not anymore. Not anymore. And then we got to Nashville, and one night she's tucking Bernadette and the kids into bed, and I'm in a den doing some writing, and Mama gathers her paraphernalia. She always had the New Testament, the Old Testament, the Lives of the Saints, 2 stacks of prayer cards like that, and 2 sets of rosary beads. That's what I call a prayer, you know. And she's got all this stuff, and she's heading from my dining room to do some praying. She sees me in a den, and she comes in, she puts her stuff down, and she sits down next to me. Mama wasn't even quite 5 foot tall. And she looks up at me, and she says, you know, Bill, she says, all of my life, when I read the New Testament, I read about all the miracles that Jesus performed. And then I read the lives of the saints, and I see all the miracles that the saints performed. And she said, I often wondered what it would be like to see a real miracle. And then she put her hand on my shoulder, and she said, and now I have. She saw the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's what I'm looking at right now. You stand up here and you look out, and you see the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Enjoy it and hang on to it. Thanks.